Welcome to Holyrood Unguided, the blitz spirit of political podcasts. Oh, a bit of chaos trying to get recorded this morning. It always hits differently morning recordings when it's school holidays and I've not had to get up and get the kids to school, because that normally at least gets me awake and organised early. So I was running a wee bit late this morning because my two-year-old decided to empty her bowl of cornflakes all over the place and then mix it up with some Ribena, which created a lovely concoction that she spread everywhere. And then came in and found out that Deborah had a puppy-related emergency, so she had to shoot off. So we managed to get some put together for you anyway. We spoke about the launch of the new internal group with the Scottish Green Party, the SGP Socialists. That was this obviously interesting me, Brian, as we were both members of the Green Party and former members of the Scottish Socialist Party, so it's all coming together for us. We then spoke about some of the crazy goings-on at the Tory party conference between Tory Oakey and Boris's rambling speech, where I'm sure in his head he was sounding like Winston Churchill, but sounding more like, you know, the Churchill insurance dog. We then spoke about the arson attack in the home of environmentalist Chris Packham. Just, it's a shame that people get subjected to things like this just for speaking out and things that they feel are important to them. We spoke about Len Penny getting sort of bullied off Twitter last week. This is obviously an escalation in terms of, you know, real life attacks, but it's all on the same spectrum. And it's sorry to see it, to be quite honest. I then managed to get us to talk about football, although because of the previous related puppy emergency, Deborah managed to sidestep that. So we were speaking about the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, which is involving itself now in top level sport in Britain by buying Newcastle United. So that's the agenda for you this week. I hope you enjoy it, and let's get ungagged. And it was nice to you shine. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice to you smile. Welcome, everybody. Deborah's just dropped the bombshell. Did you just say you were getting a puppy? Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, but it's not mine. It's Rosie's sister's.
You're getting somebody else a puppy.
Oh, are we recording now? Sorry.
Yeah.
We are.
Yeah.
People want puppy chat. Puppies and kittens. That's the way to get you, listeners.
What kind of puppy is it? Tell us.
A very fluffy, spoiled one.
Sometimes they have breeds.
Yes, it's one of the fancy mongrels. Cockapoo.
Oh, my pal's got one of them.
It's a lovely wee dog.
It's very, very energetic.
Yes, and smart. They're very clever wee things.
Every time I go down to watch the football with my other pal, it goes absolutely nuts because he once brought ham with him and it remembers. So when it sees him, Kevin says, usually when somebody arrives, it goes mad for like 5 minutes and then calms down. But when Brian arrives, it's just like, oh, it's the hamming man, the ham on man.
I don't carry ham for dogs.
It's not a good idea, as it turns out. Okay, well, we'll just get right into it then, because Deborah's got a puppy-related deadline. So there was the Green Party conference this weekend. One of the things that happened was they passed a motion in support of democratic socialism. The motion said, we consider capitalism incompatible with a sustainable planet and society, and will work towards building a democratic eco-socialist system which will allow people power and resources to be organised for the common good in a way that brings about the peaceful, democratic and sustainable society built in environmental, economic and social justice we are working towards. So, Brian, are we back in it? Are we in a socialist party again?
Maybe. Well, I mean, I think these sort of grand statements are great and it's good to see them being adopted by the party and then being voted through at conference and things like that. But for me, it's more about not necessarily adopting these statements, but adopting radical action that sees us start to see the things that are being spoken about in this change and shift in position, if you like. So I love everything that's in this, you know, this proposal that's been put forward and it's been accepted by the party. But for me, just need to see the radical steps towards recognising and seeing what is in the statement.
Yeah, I was working this weekend, so I wasn't able to make the conference. So this came as a bit of a surprise to me. So I messaged a few people kind of wanting to know what the significance was, and some people were quite excited by it. A couple of people kind of didn't think it was quite that significant because it wasn't actually, I don't think it amended the constitution. It was just a sort of a motion. But certainly it's better. I'd rather see them passing a motion in support of socialism than a motion in support of capitalism. So
yeah, absolutely.
Deborah, are you jealous that we're in a socialist party and you're not?
No. Well, you've just said it there. Doesn't change your constitution. Have you got any affiliated groups yet?
Well, there's a new group been launched in the back of this. We called SGP Socialists. I think it is based on the SNP Socialist group that you're a part of.
Yes, I am. I'm a West Region representative.
And they tweeted out, their first tweet said, in light of the motion passing, a new platform has been set up within the Green Party for people who identify as eco-socialist, left Republicans and social democrats. It was a bit of pushback about the term social democrats. And then, so they sort of dropped that and stressed that anarchists and communists are also welcome. I don't know, I found it a bit strange that they launched this group based on the motion. To me, it seems like, you know, if this motion means that the Greens are now a socialist party, do they really need a socialist grouping then? And particularly when they originally said social democrats, it was like, that seems to be covering everybody virtually in the Green Party. So this is a group that we're launching, a group that represents every viewpoint that's already in the party. It just seemed a bit confused to me, but I wish them luck and I'll keep an eye on it, and I might even join in the future.
I think it's a positive, just as always, for politics in Scotland. We are more socialist leaning as a nation, and the Scottish government is doing more, you know, sort of socialist policies. Not as socialist as maybe some of us would like, but at least with these sort of groups within parties, like you said, the SNP's got a socialist group. The Scottish Labour got a socialist group.
No, I'm joking. They do. There was some socialists in it at some point, but they've all been excluded.
They do have the campaigns for socialism, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. They do. I think it's like having an internal focus group. I think that's good. I think that's a good thing. So well done. I'm following them on Twitter.
Yeah, look, I mean, apart from Labour and SNP, which are designed to be broad churches, you know, I can understand this sort of group. I'm not really sure that the Green Party is a similar animal. They're more focused. I think there's less range of opinion, certainly in the Greens, than there is in a party like the SNP. But yeah, I think it can't hurt, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it becomes a kind of force for the good and a force for the left and within the Greens, and pulls the Greens even further left and terrifies the likes of the Daily Mail even more.
Absolutely. I think that this is a really good reflection of these, like, you know, these sort of scare stories that were in the, you know, in the build-up to the election and after the election and before the Greens, you know, and decided to go into like an agreement with the Scottish government. It was very much like, oh, you know, there are these, what was it Andrew Neil said about them? I can't even remember.
Eco-zealot Marxists.
Yeah, exactly, which is great. So I'm glad that they're living up to that name, which is nice. But yeah, I just think, yeah, it's true what you're saying about the scope of the Green Party, because the scope is a lot narrower than what you would get in the likes of Labour Party and the SNP, and particularly on some of the issues that's covered in this Socialist Party. I mean, for a left-leaning independent republic, well, I would argue that's probably, I would say most, like 99.9% of the people that are in the Greens would recognize that and want that anyway. So I think it's definitely true what you're saying, that it seems weird that they feel like this group feels that they want to create this socialist group, but if it brings about more left-leaning and socialist policies, then fantastic, it can't do any harm.
Yeah, it seems to me it was a group that's made up to include everybody except for, I don't know, Robin Harper and some liberal that's really into gardening.
Yeah, those ones.
Okay, well, we move on to talk about the Tory party conference. There was, when I was just putting the kind of notes together last night, there was so much in this. You know, I try listening to Boris's speech, I actually literally fell asleep. So I'm not sure, I may have missed something big towards the end. But I don't know, I'll let one of you go first. Did you hear any of the stuff he was coming out with, Deborah?
I couldn't hear any overall his bluster, to be honest. I was more disgusted by some of the antics that were going on around the Conservative Party conference. Who actually watches the conference live anyway? Does anybody, please, any of our listeners, let us know?
I mean, I imagine the viewing figures are pretty low for these things.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they're particularly high for like the highlights, like the leader speeches. So some of the stuff in between, I don't imagine a huge ratings draw. Maybe when there was only four channels, you get more people watching it. But
I read the speech. I don't watch Boris Johnson speak ever because it just really just... It's just a complete waste of time. If you read it, you tend to save quite a lot of time. But reading it was very much just as blustery as what it would be listening to it, to be honest. There was very little in terms of actual policy or actual... It was all very much, you know, Britain can be this and we can level up, we can do all this, you know, really empty rhetoric. And I watched Question Time on Thursday with Rosie Jones, and she summed it up really well, that actually that this speech was very similar to something that Trump would say, very much along the lines of, you know, we can be great, we can do this, we can do X, Y, and Z without actually putting a plan in place. So that's something to take note of in the direction of travel with Westminster politics. But yeah, there wasn't very much to really actually talk about in this speech, because it was all just about how great UK is and how, you know, these terrible various crises that we're facing across the UK was part of some plan, almost excusing some of the things that's happening. And I think what's even scarier is as we head into winter and as the cost of gas and other fuel increases, and we've got, you know, logistical issues and you know, staff shortages that seem to be, you know, causing infrastructure not to function as it should. We're heading into winter, and the people that always struggle is people that already don't have enough to function from one month to the next at the moment. And to somehow say dismissively that this is some part of some great plan is really, really terrifying.
I found the speech quite interesting for the point of view of, see, if you didn't know who Boris Johnson was and didn't know that he's a liar anyway and took everything at face value, it came across quite left-wing in a lot of ways. You know, he praised the NHS and what a great institution it was and, you know, how supportive like the Tories have always been to the NHS. That's where the sort of fantasy bit's coming in. You know, but when Tories praise the NHS to me, I always feel it's a bit like Bernard Matthews praising a turkey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you feel as if they value it, but they're just looking to carve it up and put it in the menu.
That's basically it, yeah.
And then he was talking a lot about, when he was talking about Brexit, it was a very kind of Lexit sort of portrayal of Brexit. He kept talking about, you know, a high-wage economy and things like that. Then he was talking about better working conditions for truckers. And you were just like, he's completely outflanking Starmer on the left because Starmer is so terrified to say anything progressive that, you know, somebody like Boris Johnson, with very little effort and a wee bit of rhetoric, can sound like a communist compared to him.
Yeah, sorry, and you go, Deborah.
No, I was just going to say, the bits I heard through his bluster were just the usual, you know, rule Britannia, we're great, wonderful empire. So I must have missed all that Lexit stuff.
The big red flag got up, high skills, high wages, right? That's a load of nonsense, right? Because the only way that you achieve high skills and high wages is through collective bargaining, through legislation to actually put a floor on certain things. And that's not the Tories. But also, high skills, high wages was the rhetoric of people like Gordon Brown. And we saw how that turned out. So I think that, yeah, it sounds left-leaning, but the only way for us to bring about high skills and high wages is to actually either invest in our infrastructure, regulate the jobs market, and basically almost provide people with the standard of living that they deserve so that people are happy at work. It's all of these different things. It's about creating the, you know, a good economy for people to function in and that choose to, that have got the choice to work in certain things that they want to work in. But that's not going to be brought about by Brexit. It's just a fantasy. And it's the same thing, you know, if you look back at some of the speeches that Gordon Brown made around high skills, high wages, it's very much like, oh yes, you know, investing and pushing through technology and AI and all these different things. But we've seen that, yeah, it might create some high skilled jobs, but ultimately it results in reducing the workforce that's required. And society and government needs to address that and say, well, do you know what, people perhaps need to work less and be paid more for the hours that they do, and then there'll be more jobs to go around, and then no one is impacted by these reduction, particularly in manufacturing jobs.
There was a couple of really bizarre moments in the speech as well. He started talking about pet thieves at one point. Mm. I was confused. I don't know if I dozed off for a second and woke up, but he was talking about pet thieves and how there was no, anybody can steal a pet, there's no level of their depravity. And I was like, is his advisors looking for ideas by trawling like local Facebook groups or something for ideas for his speech? Because I was not aware that that was a big national issue. There was also another bit, I mean, again, this, the sort of liberal progressive veneer he had when they were he was talking about violence against women. But there was a bit where he clearly messed up his cues, because he said, too many men are getting away with violence against women. And then he paused for applause. And there was this awkward silence. And then he went, and that must end. And everybody started clapping. It was like, he'd clearly just been told to keep pausing after big statements. But hadn't he thought, oh, wait a minute, probably we don't want people cheering for violence against women.
You know, the guy that also said, and violence from women against men, or like, did he not contradict himself?
That was Dominic Raab.
Oh, Dominic Raab, sorry.
Which was, he says misogyny is wrong, whether it's men against women or women against men. Like,
oh. But yeah, if he seems to think that, you know, yeah, if he thinks that, and perhaps he actually thought that, I don't know. And he was getting his cue cards mixed up the wrong way around, as she said. So, yeah, I don't really think Boris Johnson particularly cares about gender-based violence, if I'm honest. So,
I don't really think he cares much about anything.
No.
Like, you know, I don't think it was a problem for him to throw some sort of liberal progressive things out, because I don't think he particularly believes in anything. So if somebody tells him the best way of winning the next election is to sound like Karl Marx, I think he'd shrug his shoulders and do it, you know. It's very strange that he, I mean, I think he's quite obsessed by portraying himself with Churchill.
Yes. And
certainly, everything about Churchill is like, they're apparently very similar in terms that Churchill never really had an eye for detail when he was pretty disorganised and things like that. But even people that hate Churchill admit he was a good speaker and orator and inspiring. You know, Boris doesn't have that, you know.
No.
I mean, he just, the only good thing I can say is, it was a lot shorter than Starmer's speech.
Yeah.
I think it was like half the amount, I think.
But he has sort of got that after dinner speaker bluster, doesn't he? Like, so maybe in some circles, he's a great speaker, because maybe it doesn't matter if you've drank 5 litres of sherry or port or whatever they drink in big banqueting halls.
He knows what audience he's speaking to. Like,
yeah.
Like, he threw a few veiled digs towards Corbyn during the speech, and I think he calls him corduroy communist or something like that. but again, it's interesting. I think there was at least 3 veiled digs to Corbyn, no mention of Starmer, or no sort of indication that he was that he was referencing Starmer at all. So Corbyn still haunts the Tory party as much as he was definitely haunting the Labour party.
I think we need to talk about some of the periphery events that occurred.
The karaoke.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, Tory karaoke. Yeah, Laura Kunzberg and Michael Gove. I mean, I can't believe I'm reading this. This is like something, if you put it into a script, it would get thrown out for being too ridiculous. The BBC's chief political correspondent and a cabinet minister had a dance off in a rap battle. Imagine putting that into writing that into a sitcom. You know, like, that's beyond anything that you ever saw in the thick of it. And another Tory MP sang Ice Ice Baby. I mean, somebody was singing Dancing Queen. There was the policy editor of Newsnight, apparently, was singing Dancing Queen. And then had a go at Angela Rayner. You know, what
and
is
Teresa, it? Teresa Coffey.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the time of her life.
Yeah.
Hours after cutting benefits, she was having the time of her life.
Oh. Yeah.
Brian, you love a cringe. Was that one of your, did you appreciate that?
I certainly didn't appreciate it. I certainly, there was something there that was just like, oh, awful. But I think like the Teresa Coffey one was particularly distasteful. I think that, you know, and again, this has been discussed in some of the sort of other mainstream sort of political programs. It's like, oh yeah, well, she was at conference, you know, allow her to have a good time, blah, blah, blah. I was like, her department has just cut the most vulnerable people in this country's weekly income as fuel prices are rocketing. Just take
and cost 11.
And cost 11 and precarity that underpins life, work, everything at the moment. And she's just singing, I had the time of my life. And it just doesn't sit well at all, does it? And I think
it's crass, just, wasn't it?
Oh, just, and yeah, and just the timing, everything is just awful. Really, really awful. So yeah, was it cringe? Absolutely. Normally would I laugh? Yeah, but I think with the context behind this one, like it's just not funny. Do you know what I mean? It's just not funny. But obviously these people find that it's acceptable to do these things, and that's fine. If that's what they think is the right thing to do, go on and have the time of your life. But I just think at the moment where so many people are struggling, I just, you know, it's not great, is it?
I think what's really sort of revealing is how chummy the sort of like leading members of the press are with, you know, people at top of government. You know, that's no how it's supposed to work. The press is supposed to be there about holding the government to account and speaking the truth to power. It's not about hanging about and getting drunk with them and singing rap battles with them and being their best pal. Because, you know, do we really think Laura Kunzmeyer's going to hammer Michael Gove when he completely fucks up the next thing he fucks up? Of course she's not. That's her singing partner. It's her duet partner. But of course, we're supposed to believe she's totally neutral when she's talking about the government policy or talking about Labour policy. Because as much as we all criticise the Labour Party, I can't imagine other reporters being this kind of chummy with them, because it's just a revolving door between leading members of the press and the Tory party. You know, people go for high up jobs in the BBC and then go and work for a Tory prime minister and vice versa. And, you know, then they cheat to turn around and say that the BBC's full of left-wing people. And it's like, well, why do you keep giving them jobs?
Yeah, the complicity of certain people in the media, certain print media, it's actually breathtaking. But I think that we're just so used to it now that it's not shocking anymore. And that in itself is really, really worrying.
Yeah. And also the confrontation between Jacob Rees-Mogg and that guy, Dominic Hutchins, who has cerebral palsy, and he was very brave, I thought, confronting Jacob Rees-Mogg. Just saying he's an Etonian millionaire, what does he know about benefits, basically? Did you see the follow-up video? I had just tweeted it. I hadn't seen it until this morning.
Oh, the one when Jacob Rees-Mogg talking to the reporter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was really revealing. You could see how much more comfortable Jacob Rees-Mogg was in the second video. You know, he'd sort of get his ducks in a row and knew what he was supposed to say, where you could see he was clearly caught out and didn't know what to say to the gentleman. It was, the first video was difficult to watch because you could really hear how upset and emotional the guy was. You know, he was talking about, you know, he had a job, and think like the Tories are saying, no, we're cutting these benefits and stuff to help you get a job. And he's like, I had a job until you took it away from me. You know, then so he winds up in benefits, and then they start cutting the benefits and then telling him that it's his fault because he's not got a job. It's just, it's quite sick the way that, I mean, we've spoken about this before, but there's just such cruelty based in the whole benefit system.
Mm-hmm.
They're lacking compassion.
Yeah. And I think, because would he not try and, like, Jacob Rees-Mogg basically panned Dominic off by saying, just go speak to your MP.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really horrific, dismissive thing to say to somebody who's clearly got something really important to say, who's got the experiences of not only working in with youth services, which are being absolutely slashed, has been through the universal credit system, and is then, you know, as you're saying, basically saying, well, you know, we've got to cut these benefits, so, you know, you need to find another job. And, you know, and that's just putting the onus on the individual when structurally the Tories are doing it, making everything difficult for him to function and to therefore be in a position to mentally and physically find a job. The first video was really, really uncomfortable to watch, and do you know what? I just think it's amazing that he done that, and he, you know, that's what you call speaking truth to power. So take note, people in the media. That's what you do, and you interview and you speak to people with real life experiences of how Conservative policy and New Labour policy and any other Scottish Government policy impacts directly on people, and actually get these individuals to craft answers or speak to these politicians, because this is the only way that we're actually going to get real honest discourse around some of the decisions that's been made. Because yeah, there's been a lot of talk around the £20 cut to universal credit, and that's positive. You know, a lot of people across the political spectrum are pretty horrified by that. But at the same time, like, how many times have we actually heard from somebody that is actually going to be impacted directly by this? And I would argue very little.
It's a great point, that, because it's hard to imagine a reporter sort of actually speaking to a government minister like that, like, and really holding them to account and saying, like, when they try to pan them off, saying, like, oh, no, we're investing in getting jobs. Saying, no, you've taken the jobs away already.
Mm-hmm.
That's why a lot of these people are on benefits. And I think if a reporter did that, I think the rest of the press would, like, in the days after, the focus would be on the conduct of the reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how we wound up in this sort of position now, where being polite to a politician is more important than the carnage their policies might be inflicting. I generally don't know when that happened.
The follow-up interviewer was actually really good, I thought, after the initial confrontation, which I think was so powerful, because Dominic was really honest and open about a lot of things. And I think that's what caught Jacob Rees-Mogg off guard, because Dominic was explaining, well, the PIP was trying to get me to prove that I had cerebral palsy, which is a congenital condition, which is, you know, a systemic failure of the disability welfare reforms. And in the follow-up interview, if you watch that, as you say, Jacob Rees-Mogg had collected himself, and he had all the sort of press statements that are very typical of Tories anyway. But he was making lots of assertions like, oh, PIP is there helping more disabled people than ever. Whereas if he had just listened to Dominic, he would have heard that that isn't what's happening. It's an unfair system that, you know, changed the mobility element for a lot of folk, that changed, you know, care qualifications and changed how you report stuff, and instead you don't get sick notes. You know, there's so many little tiny changes to the whole entire welfare system. As Brian says, it's often focused around the big sort of headline newsies that are happening at that moment. But Jacob Rees-Mogg, he then went on to say, oh, and he's lost his job because of the council. You know, he was blaming the council without addressing, well, why is the council having funding cuts? Is that because of decisions made in central government? It was very frustrating. And Jacob Rees-Mogg was so condescending, so patronising. It was, made me very, very angry. Still very angry.
He's always quite sure he's sell Jacob Rees-Mogg, like, but you could see in the first video that he didn't feel comfortable just making the definitive statements, because he knew that this guy knows better, like, in terms of, whereas you could see he was more comfortable with the reporter, that he wouldn't quite get challenged the same way when he made sort of grand statements about whose fault it was and things like that.
Yeah.
Also, a lot happened at this conference, because Ian Duncan-Smith also got hit by a traffic cone.
So he did.
I don't really know any other details than that, except five people have been arrested. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you see Ian Duncan-Smith and there's a traffic cone sitting there, what are you supposed to do? Not happen with it.
Did somebody mistake him for a statue?
Similar charisma. Our next segment up, it's our new segment for this season, Reasons for Independence.
Hello, my name is Jean. I've been a long-time supporter of Independence for Scotland. I'm old enough to remember a time when Britain was truly great, but it hasn't been so great for a while. My reasons for supporting independence isn't about what we once were, but rather what we can become. A better nation for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I have seen many political leaders come and go over my life, but I clearly remember the election of Winnie Ewing and the excitement of my community in Glasgow East End. I see that hope and excitement once again from my sons and daughters, my grandchildren, and even great-grandchildren for the opportunities that independence for Scotland can bring to protect the NHS, to protect our environment and to protect our children's future. I'll vote yes for independence when it comes around. Thank you.
And welcome back. We're going to talk now. Our next story here is there was an arson attack in the home of Chris Packham, the environmentalist TV presenter. I always remember him from the Really Wild Show back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he's not going to be intimidated by this fire attack at his home. He told the BBC that intimidation will not stop him from campaigning on environmental issues. Two masked men set a vehicle on fire at the gate of his home in the early hours of Friday morning, causing a lot of damage. One of the things he speaks out a lot of is anti-hunting, and he's become quite a hate figure for a lot of that sort of countrywide side of line, sort of rural right crowd. But he was talking about how this is just an escalation of harassment that's been on for years. He's not saying it's like a common occurrence for him to find dead animals tied up at his front gate and outside his home. It's just horrible to see.
This one, I read, obviously, Chris Packham, you know, great campaigner, really, really outspoken, really knowledgeable, and just an all-round genuinely nice person, from what I've seen anyway, in the public domain. And yes, I watched the Really Wild Show when I was younger. It's great. But yeah, speaking out against the powerful and the elite, and particularly on issues around hunting, climate change, you know, diversity, biodiversity, things like that, that really seem to upset a lot of powerful people. And for someone to target him in this way, or I think particularly leaving dead animals and things outside his home when it's something that he's clearly really passionate and empathetic about, I think is just horrendous. But also, like, this particular attack as well could have been a lot more damaging than what it was. And, you know, good for Chris Packham to say, you know, it won't stop me from speaking out about these things. And that's a great thing. But it just makes you think what goes through people's heads and targeting certain individuals with actions. This guy is like, please don't kill animals for sport and have a laugh over it with all your rich pals. And that, for some reason, is okay to target him in this way for calling out these things. It's just...
To me, it's very, like, an act of a gangster feud. Like, mm-hmm. it's terrorism in somebody's home. It's horrible. A Land Rover, like, you know, the staple of the landed gentry, sort of giving it away. Oh, wasn't it us? We wouldn't have used the Land Rover. That's too obvious. Like, I think it goes to show what an impact Chris has on animal rights, environmental issues, on, you know, he seems to me like a really gentle soul. I mean, Brian, we were just talking about that before you came on, David. I think to attack not just Chris, but his family that live in the home, like, why? And the hanging up dead animals, will say, oh, that's tradition in the countryside. You can go anywhere in the countryside and see people hanging up goose or pheasants or hare. Well, yeah, that's sort of the problem. It's kind of, you know, gross, and when they live in medieval times, would we have to do that? There's also the issue of, as Brian says, the wealthy, the powerful, the elite, who owns this land, who's making a profit out of it, who's, you know, maybe employed by the big coos that's, you know, the lackeys or gillies that have been sent to do this. Because there's, I doubt very much it's, you know, the laird himself that went down and harassed Chris, but it's most definitely the laird or whoever the landowner is. What do they call them down there? Is it barons or dukes? Or who knows? It's very, very telling and disturbing that he's been targeted the way he is. It's the same as any sort of environmental campaigner. They're always an easy target for these guys who are so rich and powerful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very frustrating.
When people are sort of turned into like a hate figure, which he has been amongst certain sections of rural communities, you know, things like this can happen, like, and escalate without it being a grand plan. What I think is quite chilling about this is not just two, this was the two drunk guys down the pub who were going on about how much they hate Chris Packham and then decided they were going to, you know, do something about it. You know, like, they used a Land Rover, like, that.
Mm-hmm.
That even if it was an old Land Rover, that's still a lot of money that somebody put into actually organising this kind of attack.
Yeah.
You know, and speaks to another level of organisation and financial backing, which is takes it to another level.
That's what I meant, by the way, just to be clear about it being a sort of gangster shield, wasn't he? Suggesting that it was just gangsters that done it. Like, to me, it sounded like, you know, like that sort of vengeful sort organized. Of thing. Organised, yeah.
The other thing is like, how often does the right go on about cancel culture every time something cheeky said to them on Twitter? You know, is this no cancel culture? This is somebody who is actually having their life threatened based on, you know, their opinions on certain issues.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, it's really important to reflect, and this is, like, something that me and my partner talk about quite a lot, is, you know, the types of rights and stuff that Chris Packham speaks out for. We always talk about animal rights, and it seems like a distant thing, but in some sort of academic circles, when they talk about it, it's like non-human animal rights. So to really clink everything together, because, you know, when you talk about, you know, hunting or how we mass produce animals to be slaughtered for us to eat. I mean, I'm vegetarian. I tend not to preach about it to a lot of people because it instantly shuts people down really, really quickly. But it's just how so many people have a different attitude towards animals. And I think that it's really, really important that perhaps when we talk about these things too, to always remember to put non-human in front of it, because it really differentiates. You know, we talk about human rights and you've got non-human animal rights. And I think that it clinks a lot of things together, because these animals are in the same, you know, the same biodiverse ecosystem that we operate within, that humans are systematically destroying certain aspects of it. And these animals can't speak. They have no democratic mechanism to stop these things from happening to themselves, apart from some humans that speak out, and people like Chris Packham who do it in a really sophisticated way, in a way that people can understand, and people, you know, talking about the truth to power, talking about, you know, how this impacts on animals and all these other really, really important issues. And this is why it's so important that we amplify these voices to these people, because who's going to speak up for the animals? Because they can't speak.
I think
they're
as well,
just
I think
animals.
Exactly.
If it was some animal rights campaigners or hunt saboteurs that done something like this against, like, maybe a Tory MP, I feel as if there would be a far bigger reaction. There was decent coverage of this in the press, but I don't think necessarily we'll hear much about it in the kind of weeks and months going forward. I think if it was like animal rights campaigners had done something like this, you know, the Prime Minister would have been asked to speak out on it. I think they'd be talking legislation, using terrorism laws, whereas this has been treated very much like just like a criminal act. It's not been treated as something political, really. It was only Chris Packham that's really like spoke about how this is really just, isn't it a one-off event? It's just an escalation of things that he's been subjected to over a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's really unfair. And it's surprising as well, because the type of folk who, you know, are against Chris Packham are always on about, you know, private land rights and these hunt saboteurs are coming destroying our property and, you know, trespassing on our land. And then this happens to Chris Packham's front gate. Like, a wee bit of hypocrisy there and all. It's disgraceful. It really is. I'm just disgusted by it. Solidarity to Chris.
Before we move on, there's something else I have to say when I was kind of looking into this story. Chris Packham, 60 years old. The guy looks amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
When you think about the Really Wild Show was about like 35 years ago, so it makes sense that he's that age, but
60, wow.
Look at Deborah's face. She's just...
That's what kindness does. There you go. Kindness is beautiful.
Compare that to Katie Hopkins in her withered, evil sort of...
The shade.
Visage.
Right, I know you are going to talk about football next, so I'm going to...
Yeah, Deborah, why are you leaving me?
Finally, I'm going to abandon you.
To talk about football, I
finally get football on the agenda. Here we go, this is my time to shine.
Bye, I'll Deborah.
See you next week.
See you later, Deborah. Bye-bye. Thank God she's away.
You're going to get it.
Oh, no, she edits this. She'll hear that.
I know, she will.
No, it's a joke that me and my mate sometimes play sometimes, that if we're at somewhere, if somebody leaves, you say, thank God they're away, and the other person goes, that was out of order. Everybody in the room automatically stops what they're doing and wants to know what they've missed. That's great. now we've got to talk about football, which Brian, I can tell, is very excited about. But we're specifically talking about Saudi Arabia's public investment fund buying Newcastle United. The takeover of the club in a £300 million deal has been universally welcomed by their club supporters. And the Premier League says that they've received legally binding assurances that the Saudi state will not control the club. And that's a bit of a strange assurance to take, considering the public investment fund is controlled by
the state,
the Crown Prince, and the Crown Prince and the royal family are effectively the state. So I think they're really hiding behind sort of legal niceties there in terms of that. Of course, the Crown Prince has been directly implicated in the murder and dismemberment of a journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, a few years ago. The Saudi state, we know, is involved in some have said a genocidal war in Yemen. They're a country that beheads a lot of people for a lot of things in terms of a lot of sort of crimes. And now they are going to be owners of, you know, a top flight club in the English Premier League. Any opinions, Brian?
Well, my knowledge of football is quite limited, which I'm sure will not surprise you. But when we talk about ownership of football clubs, it's just a real shame that because they've become such big beasts that they have to be owned by such big entities, and that they end up in like such financial strain in the first place, which can lead to situations like this happening. It's just a real shame that they can't just be owned by the fans and whatever collective mechanisms could be used to do that. It's just a real shame. But in this particular instance, Saudi Arabia is a really problematic state in terms of how it operates, and that in itself should concern a lot of people who are either supporters of the Newcastle Football Club. I really just don't know where to go with this one, because it's just, you know, if you're saying that they need legal text to say, yeah, but it's, you know, there's going to be no involvement by the Saudi state, well, why did they feel that was necessary in the first place? So are we saying that we're concerned about this, or is this just a, you know, legal text or framework that we would get with any other sort of takeover? I don't know. But obviously, you know, we can talk about all the human rights issues in Saudi Arabia, capital punishment, LGBTQ plus people, treatment of women, treatment of the states that they are involved in these wars, such as Yemen. It's just, it's just such a really, really, yeah, terrible, terrible.
Yeah, I mean, the fans are kind of delighted with it. I mean, the previous owner was Mike Ashley of Sports Direct, so it really was taking somebody to take a step down in terms of, you know, the kind of standing of the moral standing of their owner. And the fans wanted rid of Mike Ashley for a number of reasons. As a football fan, I can kind of relate. Football fans can be extremely hypocritical in these sort of things. You know, because even myself, a Celtic supporter, I would not like to see, you know, Celtic getting taken over by a group such as the Saudi Public Investment Fund. But in the back of my mind, I would think, oh my God, we're going to have so much money to spend. And that's quite seductive for a football fan.
Mm-hmm.
But this is quite a natural step for the Saudis to take, because they've been engaging in sports washing, as it's been called, in order to, you know, use sports to kind of rehabilitate their image. They signed a 10-year working relationship with the WWE to host a lot of big wrestling shows there, which are shown in the WWE network.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also started hosting a lot of high-profile boxing matches and things like that. And it's really so that when people think of Saudi Arabia, they think of things other than, oh, that's a place that chops people's heads off, and that's a place that's, you know, turning Yemen into a graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it works.
Well, these things do work. I mean, this is where regulation comes in, and where, you know, perhaps there shouldn't be an opportunity for a fund like this to own a football club here in the UK, because there should be standards put in place, whether it be human rights standards, whether it be environmental standards and international relations standards. All of these things should be taken into consideration when it comes to investment from other countries. But of course, we know that's not the case. And if we want to be a positive role model across the world, then, you know, the one way that you can do this, and we've seen this historically with boycotts and with sanctions happening in countries like South Africa, for example, during the apartheid, that these things can work and can bring about positive change. So if the UK state actually cared, which I don't think it does, and under the current government, then they could, if they wished, to regulate to ensure that public funds in countries like Saudi Arabia that has such terrible human rights record, but they choose not to. So unfortunately, these things are allowed to happen. And I can understand what you're saying from a football fan's perspective. It's not something that I understand fully or relate to. But yeah, being hypocritical. I mean, Mike Ashley, yeah, he's a terrible, you know, he's basically the Philip Green of the future. You know, something's going to happen very similar to what happened to the poor people in Arcadia and BHS under Mike Ashley. But there's a big difference between Mike Ashley's, you know, business ethics and the human rights record of the Saudi state.
Yeah, as far as we're aware, Mike Ashley has not mutilated anybody.
Yeah, I mean, from my, you know, I could talk a lot about Mike Ashley. That's something I know a lot about from employment perspective. But yeah, I think that it's always, yeah, if we talk about these two, you know, heads of a football team, then there's, you know, they're very, very different entities.
Yeah, I think Labour at the last election had a policy of trying to move football clubs towards fan ownership.
Yeah.
And we've seen that in Scotland. Hearts and Motherwell, I think, are both completely fan owned now. The trouble is, in the English top flight, like you mentioned, there is so much money involved that it's not really feasible for, you know, without some kind of government involvement or government scheme. It's hard to see how fans could ever manage to take control of one of these big clubs when we're talking about the vast sums of money involved.
Exactly. This is the issue. And it's the same as all like top flight sports, really, you know, really where there's a lot of money invested and advertisement used and all these different things. It's just completely, you know, without being cliched, really takes the fun out of what sports should be about. Again, I am not the biggest sports fan, so I'm not the expert in this by any means. But to me, it just seems like when you're excluding people, and that's basically what these firms are doing, you know, for the cost, whether it be their tickets, whether it be their season tickets, whether it be, you know, to have a stake in the club or, you know, be a director or be any of these things, then you're just excluding people. And that's not, in my understanding, what football, particularly in working class communities, should be about. And, you know, it's been allowed to happen gradually over the last, you know, 30, 40 years or however long it's been. And that's the major problem. This is how we've ended up with, you know, people like the Saudi public funds owning Newcastle United Football Club.
Yeah, I mean, particularly a club like Newcastle, they're a club that they're very well supported. It's a one club city, Newcastle. They're very well supported with the locally. They've not really historically had much success, but are still well supported despite that. So they're not a club that's traditionally attracted a lot of glory hunters. But you just feel as if, you know, Newcastle's going to lose something of their soul in this. They might start winning trophies for the first time ever, but, you know, those Newcastle fans that have always been there and always supported, kept the club going, you know, they'll start seeing themselves pushed out as, you know, tourists start flocking in to go to games because they want to see whatever massive signings that they've made. And there's been this, we've seen it happen at Newcastle, at Manchester City, where the were bought over from a similar sort of group from the United Arab Emirates. And you hear these phrases now, which kind of sickens me as a football supporter, but they talk about legacy fans. And it's like, well, that you mean the actual fans? The legacy fans are the people that have always supported it way before you turned up with your buckets of cash. And, you know, like, they're sort of seen as a side issue because they're more focused now in, you know, bringing in new consumers rather than fans. It's whether it's whether that means selling shirts in China or Japan or bringing in more middle-class people that treat it as like a night at the opera rather than the kind of working-class pursuit that it's always been.
And this rings true with so many different things that people do for enjoyment. I mean, you know, apply this to pride as well, like how pride has developed and changed over the last, I don't know, 30 years, and where people have been pushed out, where somebody's at my door. Wait there now.
I'm all alone. This has never happened before.
Ah, it's just a parcel. Nothing.
Somebody came to my door, but I've got people that deal with these sort of things.
I don't. So I've got to fetch my own door. Where was I going with this? With pride, yeah, where people are basically being pushed out. You know, for example, like there was the situation a couple of years ago in Glasgow where it was like the Steps big after party and it was like 45 quid a ticket and stuff like that. And then they oversold the tickets because they wanted to maximize their profit because, you know, that's the sole aim of this whole thing. And basically people were excluded from it, whether it be for they couldn't afford to pay for it in the first place or the fact that there was just terrible administrative errors where there was too many tickets sold. So, you know, when you grow something to be so big, you lose the point and why it was created in the first place. So, you know, I don't pretend to believe and understand how football clubs are created and how that makes certain fans feel because I don't understand it. But similarly with things like pride, where people feel community, they feel acceptance, they feel, you know, all the things that you know, humans enjoy and want to feel, just brought along by and expanded by big business, where you end up with really unscrupulous characters at the top.
Yeah, I suppose it's a kind of, it's a form of cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. It's like an appropriation of working class pursuits for, you know, by more middle and upper class and right up to royal now, if we're talking about the Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just kind of feel as if the Newcastle fans might be happy now and might be happy for a number of years, but I wonder if one day they might all look back as this being, you know, the worst thing that ever happened to their club.
Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely possible. But I hope that this might be a way for some Newcastle United fans to mobilise and highlight some of the human rights abuses by the Saudi Arabian state. I think that would be something that could positive could come out of it. I'm just being really optimistic.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just thinking. I remember thinking of a quote by Jesus. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and mm-hmm. lose his soul? Mm-hmm. And I feel as if that's where the Newcastle fans are like now.
Mm.
But I don't think they see it. I think they're blinded by they see the millions and the new signings that will be rolling in, and I don't think they can see past that at the moment. But
yeah, usually when something's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. So it's you know, and I think that the same can be applied in a lot of different aspects, and particularly in a capitalist society. If money's been thrown at something, it's not for the benefit of the working class, is it?
It is not. Anyway, that's us finished then. That's our topics over for another day. Thank you, Brian, for seeing it to the end.
Very welcome.
Not prioritising puppies over the podcast.
Well, I had to get a parcel, so... You know, there's loads of things getting in the way of doing our podcast, but we persist.
Puppies and Parcels, I think we've just found the name of the podcast.
The actual name of the podcast, very good. But thank you very much, and we will speak
thank
you,
Brian.
Next week.
Thank you, Deborah, who will hear this when she edits it, and thanks everybody for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
I don't know, slagging me off when I leave the Zoom and then forgetting to tell yous, go and follow us. @_ungagged. You can tweet us anything you like, get us to talk about stuff on the podcast. You can also go and see all the other stuff we do. We do articles, poems, reviews on leftungagged.org. If I can ask you also to go and give us a wee rating, preferably 5-star, But any sort of rating, we appreciate it on whatever platform you use to listen to the podcast. Thanks very much for listening. See you next week. Bye. And it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice.